And Aaron got his PhD in Berkeley, right?
That's right, yeah.
And you did one postdoc at Harvard?
It's Slack, actually.
It's Slack and then Harvard, right? You were 1 year at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and then you went to Michigan.
Yep.
You'll tell us about quantum and dark matter.
Okay, great. So thanks very much for having me. Actually, I just realized on this slide there's something that's wrong. So my collaborator, Nashin Shah, is actually going to be moving to a faculty position at Wayne State rather than Pittsburgh. So thanks very much for the invitation. So indeed, I'm going to be telling you a little bit about co-annihilating dark matter, which is a very old story. But we found some things in the literature just a little bit puzzling, and so we just wanted to sort of clear things up a little bit, and hopefully I'll make things clearer and not worse. But anyway, so that's the goal, is to tell you some old things and hopefully some new ways. So the question that motivates this discussion, at least in part, why we would want to think about the co-annihilating dark matter anyway, in part comes from considerations of direct detection experiments. And so just as by way of introduction, let's remind ourselves what kind of direct detection cross-sections one might expect for weakly interacting dark matter. And I'll focus for simplicity on the spin-independent cross-section, which is typically the most sensitive. And so here's where we're going. So the first part of the talk is by way of introduction. As I said, I'm going to talk about where to expect the dark matter. And then, as we'll see, co-annihilation turns out to be a case where we expect the direct detection to be rather difficult. And I want to try and understand how difficult. So that's kind of the goal of today's discussion, is to understand exactly how difficult we would expect it to be to see dark matter at upcoming direct detection experiments. And I want to try and understand this in the most direct and as simple a way as possible, and you'll sort of see what I mean by that as we go along. So first, the question of where would we expect to see the dark matter. So the simplest thing I might have imagined if I were writing down weakly interacting dark matter is to consider weak with the capital W, so interacting via the weak gauge bosons, and then if it's interacting via the Z, you get this enormous cross-section that's set by G Fermi, and here enormous is a word that means 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared, and if you to look at current bounds coming from direct detection experiments, you can see that the scale here is something like 10 to the minus 45, and so this possibility is excluded by roughly a factor of a million. And so you need to somehow get rid of this operator that you would have for Dirac dark matter, and the simplest way to do that is by making it Majorana, in which case that spinner product written there on the left just vanishes identically by the reality condition of the Majorana spinner. So that's the standard thing, and that's what happens, for example, in supersymmetry. That process is just manifestly absent, and so instead the leading contribution to the spin-independent direct detection is instead via this chi-chi QQ bar operator. Just as a way of self-promotion, it's sort of clear that you could imagine having 1/1,000,000th of the dark matter be this stuff. And then if that happens to be true, then obviously you would still see a signal in direct detection. It could be the first thing that you would see. You would just be only detecting 1/1,000,000th of the dark matter. And so that, of course, is a logical possibility. And it turns out that there's actually some interesting collider signatures that you could get in potentially in that case. That's what that paper was about with Nick Orlovsky, who's my current student, and Jim Halverson, who's going off to Northeastern. Okay, so if we've gotten rid of this and we've taken care of our factor of a million, we're left with that. And that's what one gets if you have dark matter that interacts with the Higgs boson. And so if we have a diagram like this, there's a coupling of the Higgs to the nucleon, which is known reasonably well, but not with infinite precision, but this is known reasonably well. And so the only thing that is unknown in this diagram is that you Kawa coupling at the top there, Y, and if you parameterize the cross-section for spin-independent scattering in terms of that unknown coupling, and if you set it to be about a tenth, and we'll come back to whether or not that's reasonable in just a moment, you get a number that sits somewhere here. And so that's sort of smack in the middle of where the current experiments are at the moment. So this is the statement that these experiments are exciting. They could see dark matter at any moment. And in fact, actually, some of them are starting to, for certain models of dark matter, you might be starting to get a little bit nervous. So if you're an expert in this field, this is the statement that some of these sort of well-tempered models are starting to get a little bit squeezed.
But I thought the pure xenoid is now like uber safe, right, because of this strange constellation.
Well, the pure Higgs-Zeno is a very different story. So we could certainly talk about that. But just to say, I mean, this is a slightly different story. So actually, this is this next slide, so it's fine. So I'm happy to discuss. So typically in supersymmetry, what happens is the neutralino, of course, is this linear combination of the Bino, the Wino, and the two Higgsinos. And the diagram that I drew on the previous slide corresponds to asking, do I have non-zero overlap of the dark matter with both the Bino and the Higgsino? And if I do, then I expect to have this vertex be large, because this coupling is basically just set by G prime, because this is the supersymmetric analog of the B gauge boson coupling. So this is the thing that typically sets the direct detection. You could also make this the Wino if you like, in which case this is set by G. And so this is the well-tempered story. So the well-tempered story typically is when I am determining the relic abundance, I mix the Bino and the Higgsino just the right amount, so I get the right annihilation in the early universe, and then it turns out I have a substantial overlap of both of these guys, which means that this thing is this times, if you like, a sine and a cosine, both of which are not too small, and so that gives rise to a large direct detection cross-section. And what Itai was mentioning is that there's another possibility, of course, at least for in the early universe. Maybe I should draw some. But let me postpone your question for two slides, because I'll kind of get there, actually. And so this is just a reminder. So again, this is what we just discussed. And then the question, as we wanted to say, is, you know, I came up with this number of order 0.1, and is that sensible? And so just to remind you of one way in which you might compute that is to consider the cosmology in the early universe and to try and figure out what gives you a consistent relic density. So to determine what you think the right relic density, you solve the Boltzmann equation in the expanding universe, the annihilations try to maintain thermal equilibrium, the expansion of the universe eventually prevents this, and you freeze out. So is there a pointer, by the way?
Yeah.
Hockey, of course there is. I guess it depends on if you're a hockey player, right? Just which way you point it. So if you have a weaker annihilation, then you're going to deviate from this the equilibrium curve earlier, and you'll get more dark matter. On the other hand, if you have a stronger annihilation cross-section, you'll be able to hug the equilibrium curve for longer, and you'll end up with a smaller abundance. And of course, this equilibrium curve drops like a rock. That's just the usual Boltzmann suppression, e to the minus e over t. And so as the temperature cools, your abundance drops exponentially. And if you're able to drop exponentially for longer, you end up with less dark matter at the end of the day. So that's the standard thing. Now, that just tells you that if you make a measurement of the amount of dark matter, it tells you how long you should have hugged this curve, and it tells you what the annihilation cross-section is. Okay, so that's the standard by now textbook story. And so you can go ahead and ask what size of the coupling you need to the Higgs or to other gauge bosons in order to get the right relic abundance. And in general, it turns out that if you run this story, the number that you get is actually this 0.1 sort of number is about right. And so that's the statement that things are starting to get a little bit squeezed. But there is no theorem that it has to be of order 0.1. And the reason that there is no theorem that it has to be of order 0.1 is if I had this diagram in the early universe, then that necessarily gives rise to this diagram for direct detection if I turn it on its side. But this diagram, while controlled by, is not controlled by exactly the same mixing angles as things here. So you could annihilate the W bosons. That'd be a perfectly excellent way to get rid of dark matter in the early universe. But you can see that there's no W boson that connects to the nucleon in direct detection at tree level. So you, in order to get direct detection, you have to close this loop, and now this becomes a loop process rather than a tree level one, and so that is substantially suppressed. And this actually leads to Itai's question. So if you have something that annihilates to W's, there is a direct detection piece. It looks like this. There's another direction detection piece that looks like this. And there was some debate about what the relative sign and contribution of these things were. It depends on the Higgs mass. Oh, sorry. It depends on the, so this is Higgs exchange. And the size of this diagram, of course, depends on the size of the Higgs mass. And it turns out for things that are about 125, there is a bit of a cancellation between these two. And there had been some debate back and forth whether or not there had been multiple groups that did this calculation. But I think that the answer is just settled now, in part due to some nice papers by Richard Hill and Mikhail Solon that show that indeed there is such a cancellation. And for a Higgsino that annihilates the W's, you do end up getting a very small direct detection cross-section. It turns out if you do have a Higgsino that annihilates the W's, the right dark matter mass is just about 1.1 TeV. And so that certainly is a possibility. It's not the possibility I'm going to be pursuing here, but that is one direction you could go, is just to imagine that the dark matter is all the way up at a TeV.
But this possibility sounds particularly depressing, right? Because if it's really that, we would never know.
For the direct detection.
Well, it seems like from any perspective, right?
Yeah, maybe if you had the 100 TeV, maybe you could do something there. Actually, I don't know to what extent that's been studied. Because even if you did, I mean, what I could imagine you seeing is some MET signal, right? But to actually know it's a Higgsino might be very difficult unless you get the rest of the spectrum and make a lot of measurements. So it's not so trivial.
So just for reference, yeah. What's the cross section that you predict in that scenario? How far away from?
Oh, it's really small. I think it's like 10 to the minus 48 or 49.
It's, yeah, I think it's 10 to the minus 48, I think.
Well,
we'll see some plots in just a minute, actually. It's like 10 to the minus 48, and you have to remember it's at a TeV. And 10 to the minus 48 at a TeV is pretty hard just because the number of dark matter particles that are hitting your detector is a little bit smaller than if it's at 100 GeV. So the thing that I wanted to take away from... I didn't explain this plot to you. This plot, what this was showing is that it's possible to dial this coupling to zero, essentially, and still get... So this blue curve is the relic abundance, and here you can hear something that basically agrees with the agreed value, and you can go to a place where this coupling happens to vanish. This is actually not the case necessarily of a pure Beano or Higgsino. It's just a place where the coupling to the Higgs happens to vanish. But you can still get the right relic abundance as long as other diagrams, like this diagram or the coupling to the Z, do not vanish. And so you can use that to get the right relic abundance. So, and so this is something that I did, and there's also a nice paper by Cliff and others talking about this in the context of the MSSM. Sorry, other Cliff, Cliff John. Yes? So the question about this. So there's two questions. There's the question about the Higgsino scattering through the Z for spin independent or spin dependent. for spin independent, the answer is sort of yes in principle, but no in practice. It's an inelastic scattering. So in the limit where I had my theory of the universe was literally this, but no Beano's and no Weino's and there's no mixing, then that's exactly that first model I showed you that has the Hughes 10 to the minus 39 cross-section. However, what happens in Suzy is that you have these Higgsinos that mix with the Beano's, and the Beano's are Majorana, and so that turns this Dirac particle into a Majorana particle, and so what ostensibly is happening is those two states are being split by the mixing. And so this is really this, and typically if the splittings are of order GeV, then that's something that would never happen in indirect detection. You could ask sort of at what mass scale does the Beano need to be in order that the splitting is above the amount of inelasticity that you would need to avoid seeing this in direct detection. It's something like 10 to the 9. So as long as the Beano is lighter than 10 to the 9 GeV, then these are sufficiently split that the inelasticity prevents you from having this huge cross-section of direct detection experiments. Is that clear? So there is spin dependent in principle. The spin dependent, I believe, vanishes, if I remember correctly, vanishes again exactly in the limit where is typically proportional to the difference in the HU and HD content. Okay, so the thing that I wanted to emphasize here is there's this crossing symmetry that says if there's a big annihilation, then typically there's a large direct detection. And one way to get rid of that crossing symmetry is via co-annihilation. And so let me remind you what the story is there. So we're going to talk particularly about stop co-annihilation. And so I'm going to imagine a dark matter particle and then something like a top partner. And so if you like, in the case of supersymmetry, this would be the lightest stop. And if these guys both reside in the thermal bath at the same time, which is the case if the mass splitting between this guy and this guy is not too large, then this guy can find this guy and annihilate to, say, a top and a gluon. Or two of these guys can find each other and annihilate to gluons. And both of these diagrams can be very important for determining the abundance of your dark matter. This one, it's obvious. This one is maybe very slightly less obvious because you don't see any chi's in that diagram. So you might wonder how it is that this diagram depletes the chi abundance. But as long as you have processes that are efficient in taking you between the chi's and the stops, then this diagram will also deplete the abundance of the chi's. So the analogy I like to use is that you can imagine I have a bucket of chi, a bucket of stop, and annihilation allows you to have leaky buckets. And if there's a pipe that connects these two things, then the water level in here will be affected by the hole in this bucket, right? So that's basically what's going on. And typically there are such processes because there are often standard model particles in the bulk are very abundant relative to the dark matters. And so you could, for example, scatter going this way. You could have chi's scattering off of tops giving you stops and gluons, for example.
There's also an S-channel.
Okay, so
have you looked into the possibility of having S-channel resonance in this case? So have it so that the chi mass plus the stop mass is roughly the top mass?
I think that's probably dead from limits on stops, right?
Well, if chi is light,
I think we have a slide, like the next slide or something, or a couple slides, and we can come back to this question. So the question, but before I come back to that, let me just remind you that the question about whether or not this guy lives in the thermal bath at the same time of this guy is a question about whether or not its relative abundance is strongly Boltzmann suppressed relative to him. And the Boltzmann suppression of this guy relative to this guy is the difference in their masses compared to the freeze-out temperature. And the freeze-out temperature is roughly about the 20th of the mass, or 25th of the mass. And so as long as the mass splitting is sort of 5 to 10%, there's plenty of these guys still around in the thermal bath. So that's kind of the how close these particles need to be in mass in order for these things to be relevant. Okay, so if these particles are around in the thermal bath, there's actually a very simple formalism to take them into account, which is basically take with the cross-section of all the different initial states, be it chi-chi or chi-stop or stop-stop, and just make sure you weight them effectively by the amount of particles that you have. And so if you have this stop-stop to glue-glue cross-section, here it is, you just weight that and then make sure you multiply it by, in this case, two exponentials due to the fact that I have two stops in the initial state. So that's, but you could solve the Boltzmann with this sort of effective annihilation cross-section, and that allows you to determine the relic abundance. So that's co-annihilation, and so why does this get rid of direct detection? Well, it's pretty clear that the reason I'll have problems doing direct detection here is that the cosmological processes that are important for the annihilation have stops in them, and then today I only have chi's around. And so these things don't tell me anything about the coupling of chi's to nucleons. There's no crossing diagram here that involves chi-chi to nucleon, and that's the reason that you can quickly explain why dark matter has not yet been seen. So the question I'd like to ask, and that's sort of our goal of our discussion today, is to try and understand, will it ever be seen, right? So we got rid of the big cross-section that you would expect be a crossing symmetry. And we want to ask, is there a residual contribution that eventually we should be able to target or not? And so now let's...
When you're holding fixed, is that you're assuming that in their universe, relic abundance is done through
thermal.
Thermal co-annihilation.
Thermal co-annihilation, yeah. So we'll, yeah, exactly. Okay. That's going to be the story. So, yep, that's the assumption. All right, so first of all, let's just... first go back to our question before, 10 to the minus 48, if that's the right number. Here it is at a TeV, so that's right at the border of the neutrino floor, so that's pretty tough. Okay, so again, for people who are less expert at staring at these plots all the time, what's plotted here is the WIMP nucleon cross-section versus the WIMP mass, and so there are all these bounds that's the solid lines are the ones that exist, and so all of this parameter space for higher cross sections is excluded. And then there's a host of experiments that people have proposed that will march ever and onwards downwards until they approach this floor of the neutrino coherent scattering, where you get a background from atmospheric neutrinos primarily that is a very difficult background to subtract because that looks exactly like the scattering of the dark matter, and you can't shield against neutrinos. So you could try and do some sort of subtraction if you think you know exactly what the predicted rate of neutrinos is, but this is going to be, all of these in principle, if you build a good enough experiment, are zero background experiments. Once you get down to here, you actually have a background that you have to fight against. All right, so this is taken from this snow mass paper on the future of direct detection. And there's some benchmark points here. In this one, this octagon or hexagon, is Beano stop co-annihilation, tantalizingly at the edge of the reach of future experiments. So I wanted to understand what assumptions went into this point, and so why this is sitting here at this 10 to the minus 10 picobarns, this 10 to the minus 40, about 10 to the minus 46, to the minus 47, and where that's coming from. And so let's see if we can understand that. So one of the things that makes life difficult is often the annihilation, the analyses of the difficult for my brain at least, often the analyses are done in the context of the CMSSM, and you might like that because that connects to some high scale parameters. You might not like that because it's, in my mind, probably the wrong high scale theory. It's just something that's been chosen to be simple, and it has the advantage of having a small number of parameters, so you can put it on a piece of paper and plot it. But since it has a small number of parameters, you've introduced correlations between some of the parameters that you might not want to be there. So that's another danger. And for sure, at least to my mind, it obscures the low energy physics. So you might tell me this is the, there's a stop co-annihilation region here, which you can hardly see. It's supposed to be in light blue. And apparently that occurs for M0 of order 200 and M1/2 of order 600, but I have no idea what that means in terms of what's actually happening in the early universe. And so I'd like to try and rephrase things in a way that connects more directly to the physics of what's going on. So my very first simple attempt to do that is to just say, well, I'm going to have standard model, I'm going to have dark matter, I'm going to have a stop, and then I don't care what else is above there. As long as it's sufficiently heavy, it's going to be very Boltzmann suppressed in the early universe, so it's not going to matter. And so I'm just going to talk about the interactions of these two guys with the standard model as the way to talk about the cosmology. And so the interaction is going to be primarily via this Yukawa coupling. And then I can also write down a quartic between the Higgs and the stop. And an example that would connect onto the MSSM would be that you could imagine that this Yukawa coupling, maybe up to factors of root 2, is 2/3 of G prime, and the MSSM, this would be the top Yukawa coupling, I guess squared actually. So, and then of course hidden in this covariant derivative are the other interactions of the stop, because it's a colored object, and so that's its interactions with gluons are important as well. Okay, so this is going to be the simple model that I'm going to work with, and in principle, I'm going to allow myself to actually vary this y and this lambda. But you can have in the back of your mind these MSSM values if you want to connect it onto the MSSM. So there's the diagrams that I showed you before, and let's actually look at this one first. So the very nice thing about this diagram is it depends only on the strong coupling constant and the mass. There are no free parameters in this thing other than the mass. And so this doesn't depend on the contents of the Beano, the contents of the dark matter. There's just nothing to worry about at all. It's just some number and you're done. Over here, so I'm sorry, R is the ratio of this mass to this mass. This again depends on the masses. But it also depends on this unknown coupling y. And so there is a parameter that we do have to worry about for this particular process. Another thing that you might have to worry about, it's a little bit of a complication, is that potentially the velocity of these particles in the early universe is somewhat low. And so you can get additional enhancement to the annihilations via the Sommerfeld effect. So those should be included beyond the perturbative calculations that I included on the previous. Sorry. This is going to be for stops. In principle, this would have been, sorry, this is the diagram for Kaikai to WW. I took it from one of my papers. This would be stop with a gluon ladder to glue. All right, so what do you get out of this exercise? So if I take the MSSM values of that Yukawa coupling, so that 2/3 G prime and the lambda top squared, the very nice thing is I can, because I could just plot as a function of the WIMP mass what the mass splitting should be, because that's that exponential that weights the cross section. And so this is really the physical quantity that we should care about, because this is, for one thing, is very relevant for LHC searches. You want to know what that mass splitting is. That affects how easy it is to see the decays of that stop. And if you had done the calculation without including the Sommerfeld effect, you would find the mass splitting is given by this curve. And if you include the Sommerfeld effect, what I think is in the proper way, it's this darker green curve. And so you get a, say, for example, at its peak, a shift upward of about 5 to 6 GeV. It's not a huge shift because, remember, you're exponentially sensitive to that mass splitting. And so even if you have a order one change in the cross section due to the Sommerfeld effect, you can compensate for that by shifting the mass difference by not a whole heck of a lot.
And the width of the green thing is just the uncertainty in the
omega h? No. So the width of the green thing, I'll tell you really quickly, but then we can have a longer discussion offline, is there are some people who claimed that there's a different way in which you should calculate the Sommerfeld effect, which had to do with the fact that you shouldn't think about the stops as being states of definite color because they're in a thermal bath. And so the way you calculate the Sommerfeld effect is by thinking of the non-relativistic potential between two objects, and that depends on basically the Casimir of those two guys. So the what representation there is in depends determines the attractive or repulsive force of those two guys. And there was some argument that I think is, I don't understand, at least, and I think maybe wrong, that said, well, these guys are in a thermal bath, and so they're constantly being hit by gluons, and so then that you should sort of average over all possibilities of their identity, and then you get a slightly different answer than if you do the one where you consider them to be definite color states. I think the definite color states is the correct calculation. Okay, so briefly let me comment on this LHC story. So we sort of saw in this plot that sort of 30 GeV for a pretty wide range of masses is 30 to 40 GeV is the right mass splitting. And in that regime, the stop can decay in one of two ways in the MSSM. It can either decay via an off-shell W to F prime and a B and a neutralino, or it can have a flavor-changing decay to a charm and a neutralino. And in the model that I wrote down, where I'm not telling you what's happening at higher scales, I can't tell you what's actually happening. I guess strictly as I've written it, it would be this, but in principle it can be either of them. And you can even get into situations where these are sort of comparable, and that can affect the bounds a little bit. But so Atlas is doing these, and CMS, and I've just shown the Atlas one, is doing these searches. And I've sort of drawn a line on here just to guide your eye a little bit about where this 30 GeV is. So this line is supposed to be 30 GeV away from this line. So this is the line of equality. And so this zero only goes with this axis. This is 100. So this is like 100, 100. So this is the line of equality, and so 30 GeV away from that line is here. And the bounds at very small mass splitting are dominated by searches for just monojets. So you have an ISR jet, and then you don't really care anything about the final state. You aren't seeing any of the final state decay products because they're so degenerate that you just miss all of them entirely. So that's these guys. And you can, and then this region with the red is where the charm is starting to get hard enough that you actually can see it. And so they can actually do a little bit of charm tagging, and that gives you this region here. And you can sort of see that this is right on the boundary for where those two things can happen. So this, if nothing else, should motivate you to think really hard about trying to continue to do a good job with the charm tagging in run two. And also, one of the things that's potentially relevant, and Editor was telling me that it's already happening, is you need to be very careful about placing jet vetoes in these monojet searches. Because if you're getting to the point where you actually start to see those jets and you're vetoing on an additional jet, then you might be cutting away some of your signal as you're pushing away from that line of exact degeneracy.
This is not relevant to the part of the problem, but where does it mount in the dot section?
Oh, so, sorry, with the with the spins and the spin correlation business?
The,
or? That I think is closer to the that's for more like the stealthy top region, right?
Well, in this model, you don't get.
Yeah, no, I know that doesn't affect that, but I was just wondering why it's not on this.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess maybe this might be a slightly older version of the plot, but.
So the blue strip is.
This strip.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean. On the scale of this plot, it was basically a constant, but eventually what would happen is it would do this, right? It would, if we go back to my previous thing, right? So the blue strip was basically, since it was a strip, it was sort of, I just took some number like that, but this is, you know, you can see the scale here. It doesn't really start to change appreciably until you're well over a TeV, which is not on that curve. So as I said, this would go parallel like this, and then eventually go up and hit the line. Okay. So one of the things that you might ask is what's actually determining the cosmology? I claim to you that this process is particularly nice because it doesn't depend on anything. And you can see that if you pick those values of the 2/3 G prime and the lambda top squared, when you get up to 500 GeV, that's actually already the dominant process. And so you can understand the cosmology pretty well in terms of just that alone and nothing else. There are other things to point out, again, are this thing that depends on a single power of that unknown Yukawa coupling. Here's a process that depends on two powers of that unknown Yukawa coupling. And here's a process that depends on the coupling, that lambda coupling, the coupling to the of the stops to the Higgs.
Why does the S channel not matter? Like, did he stop bar and emergence from gluon to missing color?
Oh, to QQ bar?
Yeah.
So that is just typically P wave suppressed, I guess. So I think that, yeah, so that's the reason it doesn't appear on this plot. I mean, it's there, it's just a very small fraction. Okay, so here's another, so I've so far been specializing to the sort of MSSM-ish case, where I took those values to be equal to what you would expect in the MSSM. But you could generalize things, if you wanted, by varying the mass and then varying the splitting. So normally, so in the previous plots, we were sort of taking the couplings to be fixed and then varying the splitting to get things right. Instead, I could vary the splitting to be whatever I want, but then I'll have to adjust the coupling, the Yukawa coupling, in order to compensate for the fact that I'm changing the splitting. And here I fixed that quartic coupling to be 1. As we'll see in a moment, that doesn't matter very much. And here's the sort of MSSM curve, and so this is the statement that once you got up to a few hundred GeV, you are dominated entirely by stop-stop to glue-glue, is the fact that this curve is in the red. So this is telling you what the initial state matters. So this is a stop-stop initial state, this is a chi-stop initial state, and this is a chi-chi initial state. And so here, if you like, you're paying the double exponential suppression, but that's okay because you're very degenerate. If you, as you move up, the exponential suppression is bigger, and so then you go to only having a single stop in the initial state, and then as you move up even further, the double exponential suppression is really harming you, even the single exponential suppression is harming you, so the only way to get rid of things is by chi-chi, so this is no longer co-annihilation really, and you have to jack up this coupling to take into account for the fact that you no longer have these strong annihilations via QCD. Is it clear? Okay. Oh, and I guess I can also say that down here, there you can't get the right relic abundance, because down here, just even annihilations via QCD gets rid of too much of the dark matter in the early universe.
But don't you start having Sommerfeld enhancement in that region?
Yeah, so up here, because yeah. Due to the big Yukawa coupling?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is, so probably you should not entirely trust some of these numbers once the coupling gets very, very large. So, well, you have to be a bit careful, because, I mean, that's exchange of a fermion rather than a scalar, so it's a little bit of a different story.
Don't you have a
phase
exchange?
Oh, via the lambda exchange.
Yeah.
So there, that's a different story, but it depends on the lambda. I mean, it.
Oh, well, lambda here is large.
But it also depends on the mass, right? So lambda being of order one by itself is not a huge issue, but it also depends on the mass. So you need to ask what the Higgs mass is relative to the WIMP mass. And so, I mean, just as a thing to keep in your head, you know, for Wienos, that annihilation, that Sommerfeld enhancement got to be sort of important for TeV-ish, multi-TeV, and that was for an 80 GeV beast. And so now for 125 GeV beast. So this is sort of right at the edge of where I would expect that. That's actually why we cut it off there. Okay, so coming back partially to this question, how important is lambda? Well, if it's of order one, which is what I took in this plot, if it's the top Yukawa coupling, you can see that, so it's contained in here, and that's sort of a factor of, looks like three or four, about a factor of four, smaller than the dominant glue annihilation. So you would have to jack up this coupling to a pretty large value before it's really gonna appreciably change the cosmology story. So this is just another way of showing that. So if this is as a function of the mass splitting, if you're going out to very large mass splittings, then of course it doesn't matter at all because you don't have the stops in the initial state. As you go down to lower mass splittings, then this is exactly where you would expect it to matter. So it can compete with the stop-stop to glue-clue, it's stop-stop to Higgs-Higgs. And so the way that what it's showing here is how much it affects the needed value of this Yukawa coupling to get the right relic abundance. Right, so again, remember, we're changing the mass splitting, then we're gonna choose this coupling to get the abundance correct. And so for a value, let's just pick a point here. So for this solid curve, this curve tells you the value of y chi that you need to get the right relic abundance if this thing is one. But say I jack this thing up to four, which is huge, or even two, which is quite large, then you might ask, well, how much does that change the story? And one measure of how much it changes the story is how much you have to decrease the other cross sections by getting rid of this y, making it smaller. And you can see that even there, the change is not so large in y going from one to two.
So y is the three-point coupling.
Correct.
And lambda is the four-point.
Correct. And so what's happening is I'm changing the four coupling to something really large, and then to compensate for this opening up of this new annihilation channel, I need to decrease the three-point coupling. And what I'm saying is that even with this very large four-point coupling, it doesn't affect the three-point coupling that much because it was already subdominant to begin with. But if you make it go up to sort of crazy values, then indeed it will affect the cosmology a little bit. All right, let me just skip that. So, so again, another way of talking about this is just the following picture, which says here's what channels were important. Now I've fixed the mass, I'm varying this ratio, and here's what I got when it was one, and if I instead make it two, then you can see that it's becoming comparable to the gluon annihilation. Okay, so let's come to direct detection now. So this was one of our goals, was to figure out what I would expect for direct detection in this story. So a crucial thing is that this Yukawa coupling appears squared in all of these diagrams. these diagrams are going to contribute essentially to effective operators of this form. This diagram is going to contribute essentially to effective operators of this form. And something to bear in mind is that this coupling right here is exactly the kind of coupling that we probe via gluon-gluon fusion measurements of the Higgs at the LHC. So this coupling that we were entertaining the possibility of it being very, very large is going to be quite constrained, actually, by measurements of the Higgs properties at the LHC. All right, so here... if it gets all the way up to 4, maybe it could. But just even single Higgs is by far at the moment the bigger constraint. So this is a pretty busy plot. Let me see if I can explain everything to you here. So here we have the dark matter mass. Here again is the ratio of the stop mass to the dark matter mass. And well, the first thing, I guess, as we just talked about it, I can tell you there's a curve that goes on here for gluon fusion. So things to the left of this are excluded by measurements of the Higgs properties already at the LHC. The plot of ATLAS searches that we saw have been translated to this red region. So those are the things that are already excluded for direct searches for stops. Those will improve. And so that's going to be this orange region. The green curves correspond to the values of y that are needed to reproduce the abundance, contours of the needed value of y to reproduce the abundance at that particular point in mchi, mstop parameter space. So as you move away from being degenerates, you go away from having stop-stop effective annihilation towards having the chi-chi effective annihilation. And so the coupling has to increase from being the 2/3 g prime value up to something closer to 2. The dashed blue contours are the contours of the direct detection cross-section. So as you go to bigger values of that three-point coupling, you get to bigger values of the direct detection cross-section. And this yellow shaded region is the region that will be excluded by the LZ experiment. And so you'll be able to exclude some of the co-annihilation region, but not the region where things are very degenerate and not the region that is follows the MSSM line. The neutrino, this line that says neutrino, is this very light gray line. This is the neutrino floor, which more or less hugs this curve that's close to 0.1. So the MSSM curve is actually slightly below the neutrino floor. If you wanted to do crazy things, then you could jack up this coupling to be enormous, the quartic coupling. And in that case, of course, the direct detection prospects are much better, right? Because you're making the coupling to the Higgs be much larger. In that case, this doesn't really have much to do with the MSSM, but you could imagine at least now having things you could probe even at xenon and certainly at LZ as well.
So if you go back to the MSSM curve,
yeah.
So everything on the green line is essentially a well-tempered scenario.
On which string?
On the green line.
This line? No, this is definitely not a well-tempered scenario.
Wait, so
these are all sort of Beano-y, right? This is basically very pure Beano, which is the reason that the cross-section is so low.
And you managed to get the library. Oh, sorry.
So this is exactly the co-annihilation story.
Because the co-annihilation.
Yes.
Okay. I'm just saying this is basically a bug
of the rule. It's a sad story, is what I'm saying. Yeah, so... We'll come back more to why that's so in just a minute. Let's skip that. So a slightly less simplified dark matter model is one where I include not just the lightest stop but also in principle, the rest of the stop sector. And so in that case, I have mixing between the two stops. So I have a left-handed stop, I have a right-handed stop, and mixing between the two of them. And for the moment, we'll just assume that there's a small amount of mixing in the spottom sector, but I must have this spottom in my theory simply because this guy is an SU2 doublet, and so he better come along for the ride. And to remind you, the Higgs mass is strongly dependent on this mixing parameter. So this is the statement that large A terms help you get a heavy enough Higgs mass. And so if you want to get reproduce the appropriate Higgs mass, one way to do that is to move to relatively large values of this XT parameter. So that's one statement. And that's sort of interesting for this story that we've told, because if you have large values of A terms, you might imagine that in principle, at least, it's possible to get large couplings between Higgs bosons and stops, either diagonal or off-diagonal couplings. But a caveat to that is exactly the kind of caveat that we had before. If you have big couplings between the Higgses and the stops, gluon fusion is going to be an important constraint. It turns out actually delta rho is also an important constraint. And actually, if the A terms get very large, you have to worry about charge color breaking vacua. And these actually decouple in different ways. So it turns out if you're at relatively low masses, the gluon fusion is the strongest. Delta rho is actually kind of close. But if you go up to higher masses, eventually the vacuum stability bounds, the charge color breaking bounds become important. All right, so let me tell you a little bit more about what's going on in this slightly less simple model. So now I have the dark matter mass, and I have, again, this mass ratio. And before, I told you, actually, in terms of delta m, what delta m I expected, which is basically the same thing as this r, as a function of this mass. So here I've zoomed in on a much smaller region at the lower masses. And I've shown here, actually, this full range from here to here are things that are allowed in the MSSM. So if you scan over all of the parameters of the stop sector, you will find that you can get the correct cosmology for things that have R's or equivalently delta M's in this band. I claim that I can understand a lot of that just by doing stupid things. So if I just look at stop, stop to glue, glue, and I consider that to be my only annihilation process, I could ask what curve I would have gotten, and the answer is I would have gotten this curve. So if I want a very crude estimate of what the delta M is, that's actually not so bad, and it's a lower bound, because if there are other processes that contribute, then I have to increase the mass splitting to compensate for that. So this is the only including the stop, stop to glue, glue. This is the curve reproducing this curve on this plot. So this is the, if you like, the Beano and the stop right happens to lie squarely in the middle of this. And so that difference between those two curves is largely due to this process, which is the second most dominant guy. In this simplified model, there are cases where the spottom is the NLSP. If the spottom is the NLSP, then the splitting between the NLSP and the LSP actually lies in this band rather than in this band. And the cases up here with the very largest mass splittings are precisely the cases where the couplings to the Higgs are as large as you can possibly be. So if the couplings to the Higgs are as large as you possibly have them be, that annihilation is especially important. and you have to compensate for that large annihilation by moving up to a large splitting. In our scan, there were points that went up higher, but then the gluon fusion excluded them because the coupling to the Higgs was too large. Yes, John.
So to
a heavy Higgs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in our considerations, we have always decoupled the rest of the Higgs sector. We've always taken the decoupling limit. Okay. So as we talked about, there's some notion that you might like this coupling to be largish, or it could be largish as motivated by the Higgs mass. And if that's large, then you might think the direct detection might be somewhat large. And there are diagrams like this also, particularly when this bottom is the NLSP. But as we talked about, there's limits to how large we can make that coming from gluon fusion. So what I want to talk to you about now is what, in this sort of more extended, simplified model, what the predictions for direct detection are. What I want you to take away from this plot is actually just the simple statement that there's constraints from delta rho. There's constraints from the gluon fusion or Higgs to gamma gamma. And then there's statements from the charge color breaking vacuum. And so this is actually the Higgs mixing angle. This is for a fixed lightest stop mass as you vary the heavy stop mass. And the thing that I wanted you to take away is just that in general, the gluon fusion here at low mass is excluding the most of the parameter space. And as you move up in mass, the vacuum stability constraint actually gets closer and closer. And eventually, I'm sorry, I should have plotted another one, that's going to actually supersede the gluon fusion constraint. But for all of these masses less than around 450 GeV, which is what we're going to focus on in the next couple of slides, the gluon fusion constraint is the strongest constraint. Okay, so as I said, we're going to focus on this region less than 500 GeV or so. And so this is a scan over all of these, the points in the simplified model, so just the stop sector, basically. And then all of these points give the right relic density. And the banding structure is just an artifact of the scan. The blue points are the points where we've imposed bounds from direct searches. So this is like the monojet ruled out most of this region over here. And gluon fusion. And the gluon fusion actually is ruling out most of these points up here. And that's precisely the issue that the coupling to the Higgs cannot be very, very large. And so if the coupling to the Higgs were allowed to be much larger, then you could get bigger cross-sections for direct detection, but gluon fusion prevents you from having such a large coupling, and so that gives you this blue region. And these very lightest points down here, there's actually something different that's happening. So for example, maybe this point, the dominant contribution to direct detection is actually coming from bottom-spottom loops, and the neutrino floor is sitting here. So, and you can see that, I mean, this is a log scale, but it's not a huge variation here. So this is, you're sitting within a factor of a few of the neutrino floor. And actually, once you impose the correct Higgs boson mass, if you want it to be, say, within 122 and 128, using your favorite spectrum generator, then you'll actually get these points here, a slightly even more restricted region. So this is really close to the neutrino floor. Let's skip that. Let me just look at this one. Just to convince you that we know what we're talking about, there's an effective coupling that you get from that top stop. I don't know if people can see that. Sorry. An effective coupling that you get from the stop top loop. And so that gives you an effective chi-chi Higgs vertex from integrating out the stop. And what I've plotted here is for a couple of different masses, what that coupling is versus the observed cross-section. And... Oh, sorry, this is in units of 10 to the minus 4. Yeah. So this is, a few times 10 to the minus 3. So it's a loop suppressed coupling. And so the statement is that indeed you can see there's a very tight correlation between the observed cross-section and the size of this coupling, particularly for these higher masses. And so indeed it is coming from this loop, just as I argued for you, but you can see that, remember the red things are the things that fail the gluon fusion constraint. So you might have tried to push to even higher cross-sections, but gluon fusion is preventing you from doing so. So now I should go back to this plot, which said, here is this point that's sitting way the heck above the neutrino floor, and now I just have shown you a bunch of very disappointing things where it looks like I'm hugging the neutrino floor. And so what's the difference? So, the difference is this. I talked to you about the direct detection cross-section that you get in this minimal simplified model by considering co-annihilation. Of course, it's always possible that this diagram exists. It just might have nothing to do with the cosmology in the early universe. And so the size of this diagram is controlled by the mu parameter. And if that mu parameter is not too large, then the direct detection cross-section is not super duper small. So you get a 10 to the minus 47 number, which is about what they have if you pick a TEV scale mu. So another way of saying this is we did a calculation of direct detection and co-annihilation. That calculation will be subdominant to this mixing if the mu parameter happens to be below a TEV, which could be true, but then if you were to see direct detection, you would absolutely not be probing the physics of the early universe. You'd just be probing the physics of the mu parameter. So another more optimistic way of phrasing this, perhaps, is say we go off and we measure in a direct detection experiment and we see a signal, then that's immediately telling you that you can't just have the stops and nothing else. There has to be the Higgsinos at a TEV or below, otherwise you would not have seen a signal in the direct detection experiments. So direct detection is absolutely possible, even in a case where stop co-annihilation is the dominant thing that's happening in the early universe. But what you would be probing in the direct detection experiments has nothing to do with the cosmology. So it just happens that point that they picked was some not too heavy mu point. So if you pick a 2 TeV mu, then the cross-section you would predict is here. And so that's sort of comparable to the biggest cross-sections we were seeing is 2 TeV. So if mu is below a 2 TeV, then it's comparable to the kinds of biggest cross-sections we saw. Okay, so stop co-annihilation is certainly a well-motivated cosmology, but the conclusion that we drew from our analysis is that direct detection is really very difficult, and if really you probably have to be lucky to have a small mu in order to see it. The other thing is that it's very easy to understand what the target is for the mass splitting is in these simplified models. It's 30 GeV. And so that's exactly where the focus should be. And that's also, it turns out to be sort of an interesting region because things like jet vetoes have a big effect. And also the charm tagging is sort of right at the boundary of its sensitivity. And so there's some more effort needs to be put in there. And so let me just go ahead and stop there. So thanks.
Before we take questions, let me just say that Aaron is only here for a couple of hours. So if you want to chat with him, maybe not even, right?
So if you want to chat with me, find me after the talk and we'll talk.
All right, no questions.
Yeah.
Can you point out the figure for the
scale
coordination region?
Well, the scale co-annihilation region, what, in the M0, M1 half plane? Or, I mean,
yeah,
or in the direct detection? Well, the direct detection, I mean, it's even worse in a sense, right? I mean, the Stahl co-annihilation I mean, so where did the direct detection come from in this case? The direct detection came from, in this case, either this diagram or the coupling to gluons. And if it said it's a stal, then obviously there's no coupling to gluons. And if it's, so it would be further suppressed by alphas over alpha s's, right? And then if it's, then there you could also, that you could, in principle, you could have couplings to Higgs's with stals, but the coupling of the stal to the Higgs, unless you're at very large tangent beta, and you're maybe not even talking about this Higgs anymore, is going to be suppressed, right? So it's even worse than this. I mean, another way of saying this is loop suppressed cross sections at direct detection experiments are really hard. That's maybe another way of the take home message.
Could you go back to the P plot? The
which one?
The one without all the complications of the simplified model.
One of these?
Yes, this one.
Yep.
So the, basically the reason why it's so tough to get the damage the same is that if we, so direct detection seems hopeless, but the one hope is production, it seems.
Yes.
So the fundamental problem there is...
Well, it's not a fundamental problem. I mean, it's you're just marching this way, right? You're just running out of oomph to make the... I mean, it's the combination of the... I mean, the final state is basically the monojet, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, I won't vouch for this being exactly in the right place. It might be... It could move a little... It'd be a little bit better. But it's basically you're asking what is the reach... So this is actually taken from this paper by... Lian Tao and Matt Lowe. And so it's, you're producing monojets in association with stops, sort of scalars, colored scalars that their cross-section drops off pretty fast as a function
but
of mass.
It sounds like something that should be improvable because there are those other jets in the event.
Yeah, so with 30 GeV, I mean, the charm jets might help you. And so if you're with sufficient cleverness, this might be better than this.
This might be worth emphasizing for them because it's like the current topologies that are not quite looking for, right? Like,
well, I mean, they know about stop goes to charm neutralino. Mm-hmm. What the real question is, you know, let's go back to this thing. Right, so they have some stop to charm neutralino search, which is this thing, and where that's actually they're actually trying to use the charm tagging, and I am sure I don't remember exactly, but you know typically they don't have 27 different sets of cuts for the stop goes to charm neutralino to try and cover, you know, every possible part of this window that as well as they can. Right, they usually pick one or two sort of signal regions. And but if you say like the really most important part of the signal region is right where your sort of normal set of cuts, which does really well here, is falling off, then there might be some benefit to developing another set of cuts where you're sort of where things are just a little bit different. So that's maybe worth emphasizing a little bit more.
It would be worth covering that, right? Because basically, I mean, the pod doesn't really go on forever, right? Like at some point, you also have to. You're starting to tune, right? Because you're having a TV thing with a 30 GeV speed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So even if they can cover up to a TeV, it seems like
it's
a story.
I would be convinced if you didn't see it up to a TeV. But
it doesn't sound impossible, right? Because you're not looking at the cross section. The cross section is colored cross section, so you have plenty of events.
Well, but it's colored. So often, I mean, they're radiating an additional pretty hard jet, right? So it's colored plus a hard jet. And so that does give you a bit of a hit in the cross section. I mean, it's still QCD, but. Yeah, that's a good point.
All right. No more questions. Let's thank Aaron again.